Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Folkes, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Tracy Chevalier, who reads from and discusses her new novel, Burning Bright, published by Penguin. In the weeks to come, we have Rachel Johnson, Jonathan Lethem, Sarah Davidson, Craig Childs, Michael Chabon, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you. I hope you can hear. Can you hear me? There we go. Yes, that's better. Well, I think you you get the prize. This is by far the biggest crowd I've had so far. Hello. Well done. Thank you. And I'm not surprised, frankly, because the Tattered Cover has a reputation to keep up, and you're helping them. They are a fabulous bookstore, and I really, really am delighted to be here. I think the last time I was here was October 2001, and that was a long time ago. I'm sorry it's taken me this long to get back, but I'm glad to be back, and I've not been in this branch before, and when we drove up, it was like, there's a bit of it. No, there's more. There's more. It's huge. It's like this temple to books, and it's such a delight because in this day when even Borders is closing some of its stores, you may have read the other day that they're closing their stores in London, or they're trying to sell them, and they've closed some of Walden Books, and then there are a lot of independents week by week are closing some very famous ones. I was just in San Francisco and. A clean, well-lighted place, and also Cody's books. These are very almost as famous as Tattered Cover. Not quite, but almost as famous. They've gone out of business. So I am so glad to see not only is this not going out of business, it seems to be expanding. And I'm just delighted. So long may it last. Now, tonight, I'm going to talk to you and read from my new book, Burning Bright. This is actually the English edition, but I brought it along because it's got a really tattered cover, and I thought, I can't read a pristine book, you know, at the tattered cover. I got to read one that's really messed up, so this one is. And what I wanted to tell, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about how I go about putting a story together. We'll probably get into this more, too, in the question and answer, because I'm going to read a bit, and then I'm going to ask you to ask me some questions, so start thinking up some things to ask me. But this book, what I do, as you probably know by now, is I tend to take real people, real character, real people in history, and I mix them in with characters I've made up, and I put them in situations together. Most famously with Girl with a Pearl Earring, I took the painter Johannes Vermeer and put him in the same room as this girl, this amazing girl who he ended up painting. And some of it was real and some of it wasn't. And people are always asking me, well, what's real and what isn't? Tonight I'm going to show you a little bit about what's real and what's not in this new book. I have written this novel because I wanted to find out more about William Blake, who was an English painter and poet, late 18th century, very famous in England. And I knew a bit about him, but I always found him fascinating, and I wanted to find out more. And the easiest way for a historical novelist to find something out is to put the character in a book. And then you have to read about them and find out all about them. So I did a lot of research on Blake before I started writing, and a couple of stories kept coming back again and again. And I'm going to read two bits tonight in this book that are based on real stories, real things that happened to William Blake. And I'm going to show you how I took the fact and made it into fiction. The first one is a story that was told often about Blake, but nobody knows if it really happened or not. It was said that William Blake and his wife, Catherine, they had a house in Lambeth, which that much we do know. And a friend of theirs came to visit them one day. And the friend went into their back garden looking for them. And he found them naked. And they were reading Paradise Lost to each other. And Blake said, oh, don't mind us. It's just Adam and Eve, you know. And this has gone down in the annals of Blake history, and it was reported in some of his early biographies. Of course, Blake academics now tend to dismiss it, the story, and saying, oh, it's an urban legend, and it couldn't possibly have happened. You couldn't possibly have done something like that. Well, I wasn't so sure about that, because usually there's no smoke without fire, as they say. And I thought, okay, maybe it didn't happen exactly like that, but something must have happened. Somebody must have seen something. So I decided to speculate on how this story could have come about. And that's the first thing I'm going to read you tonight. I'm going to read you two little sections. First, what was seen in this garden, and then what was made of what was seen. Now, to set the scene a little bit, the book concerns two families, the Kellaways, who have just come from the countryside to London to find a new life, and the main character, the main person in their family is a boy named Jem Kellaway. He's 12 years old, and he has met a girl named Maggie Butterfield, which is the other family who we're going to get to know a little bit. They're a London family. She's very streetwise, very extrovert. Whereas Jem's an introvert. And now they've just met each other. And I'm going to read a scene where they're standing. The Kellaways have moved to rooms right next door to Mr. Blake's house. And Jem and Maggie are standing looking out the window over the back. They're on the second floor, and they're looking out over the back gardens. And here's what they see. Jem joined Maggie at the window to look out over Miss Pelham's garden. Funny to see it from above, she said. I only ever seen it from there. She indicated the brick wall at the far end of the garden. What, you climb over it? No, not over. I ain't been in it. I just have a peek over the wall every now and then to see what she's up to. Not that there's ever much to see, not like in some gardens. What's that house in the field past the wall? Jem indicated a large two-story brick house capped with three towers, set alone in the middle of the field behind the gardens. A long stable ran perpendicular to the house, with a dusty yard in front. Maggie looked surprised. That's Hercules Hall, didn't you know? Mr. Philip Astley lives there, him and his wife, and some nieces to look after him. Mr. Astley keeps some of the circus horses there, too, the best ones. Like his white horse and John Astley's chestnut. That's his son, John Astley. You saw him riding in Dorsetshire, didn't you? I reckon so. Afterwards, Jem couldn't remember if it was the sound or the movement that first caught his attention. The sound was a soft, oh, that still managed to carry up to the Kellaway's window. The movement was the flash of a naked shoulder in the Blake's garden. Closest to the Blake's house was a carefully laid out, well-dug kitchen garden, partially planted, a garden fork now stuck upright in the rich soil at the end of one row. The back of the Blake's garden was untended and filled with brambles and nettles. Midway along the garden, between the orderly and the chaotic, sat a small wooden summer house set up for sitting in when the weather was mild. Its French doors were open, and it was in there that Jem saw the naked shoulder, and following that, naked backs, legs, bottoms. Horrified, he fought the temptation to step back from the window, fearing it would signal to Maggie that there was something he didn't want her to see. Instead, he pulled his eyes away and tried to direct her attention elsewhere. Where's your house, then? Bastille Row? It's across the field. There, you can't quite see it from here. Jem's attempt to distract Maggie failed, however, with the second, oh. This time Maggie heard it and immediately located the source. Jem tried, but couldn't stop his eyes from being drawn back to the summer house. Maggie began to titter. Lord of mercy, what a view! Then Jem did step back, his face on fire. I have to help Pa, he muttered, turning away from the window and going over to his father. Maggie laughed at his discomfort. She stood at the window for a few moments more, then turned away. Show's over. So that's what they've seen, and this is what becomes of that. A few minutes later, they go to look for Maggie's father, Dick Butterfield, in the pub. Dick Butterfield could have been in one of several pubs. While most people favored one local, he liked to move around and joined several drinking clubs, where the like-minded met at a particular pub to discuss topics of mutual interest. These nights were not much different from other nights, except that the beer was cheaper and the songs even bawdier. Dick Butterfield's club and pub life was so complicated that his family rarely knew where he was of an evening. He normally drank within a half-mile radius from his home, but there were still dozens of pubs to choose from. Maggie and Jem had already called in at the Horse and Groom, the Crown and Cushion, the Canterbury Arms, and the Red Lion before they found him ensconced in the corner of the loudest pub of the lot, the Artichoke on Lambeth Marsh. Although it was only late afternoon, the pub was heaving with people. The din was tremendous, though after a time, Jem's ears began to pick up a pattern of a song, unfamiliar but clearly a tune. Maggie plunged through the wall of bodies to the corner where her father sat. Dick Butterfield was a small, brown man. His eyes, his wiry hair, the undertone of his skin, his clothes. A web of wrinkles extended from the outer corners of his eyes and across his forehead, forming deep furrows on his brow. Despite the wrinkles, he had a young, energetic air about him. Today, he was simply drinking rather than attending a club. He pulled his daughter onto his lap and was singing along with the rest of the pub when Jem finally reached them. "And for which I'm sure she'll go to hell, for she makes me rut her in church time." At the last line, a deafening shout went up that made Jem cover his ears. Maggie had joined in, and she grinned at Jem, who blushed and stared at his feet. Many songs had been sung at the Five Bells in Dorset, but nothing like that. After the great shout, the pub was quieter, the way a thunderclap directly overhead clears the worst of a storm. "What you been up to then, Mags?" Dick Butterfield asked his daughter in the relative calm. "This and that. I was at his house. This is Jem, Pa. Looking at his pa making chairs. They just come from Dorsetshire and are living at Miss Pelham's in Hercules Buildings, right next to Mr. Blake." "Miss Pelham's, eh?" Dick Butterfield chuckled. "Glad to meet you, Jem. Sit yourself down and rest your pegs." He waved at the other side of the table. There was no stool or bench there. Jem looked around. All of the stools in sight were taken. Dick and Maggie Butterfield were gazing at him with identical expressions, watching to see what he would do. Locating an empty stool in a crowded pub could be tricky, and Jem could not find one. He tried asking for one, but those he asked paid no attention to him. He tried taking one that a man was using as a footrest and got swatted. He asked a barmaid, who jeered at him. At last, he went back to the table, empty-handed. A vacant stool now sat where Dick Butterfield had indicated, and he and Maggie were grinning at Jem. "Country boy," muttered a youth sitting next to them who had watched the whole ordeal. "Shut your bone box, Charlie," Maggie retorted. Jem guessed at once that he was her brother. Charlie Butterfield was like his father, but without the wrinkles or the charm. Better looking in a rough way, with dirty blonde hair and a dimple in his chin, but with a scar through his eyebrow, too, that gave him a harsh look. Jem sensed something about Charlie that made him avoid the other's eyes, as you do a growling dog. Dick Butterfield sat back. "Well, now, what have you got to tell me, Mags? What's the scandal today in old Lambeth?" "We saw something in Mr. Blake's garden, didn't we, Jem? In their summer house, with all the doors open." Maggie gave Jem a sly look. He turned red and shrugged. "That's my girl," Dick Butterfield said. "Always sneaking about, finding out what's what." Charlie leaned forward. "What'd you see, then?" "We saw him and his wife at it." Charlie chuckled, but Dick Butterfield seemed unimpressed. "What, rutting is all? That's nothing you don't see every day you look down an alley. Go outside and you'll see it round the corner now. Eh, Jem? I expect you've seen your share of it back in Dorsetshire, eh, boy?" Jem gazed into his beer. A fly was struggling on the surface, trying not to drown. "Seen enough." "It wasn't just that they were doing it," Maggie persisted. They'd taken off all their clothes, hadn't they, Jem? We could see everything, like they were Adam and Eve. "And do you know what they were doing while they did it?" "What, Mags?" Maggie thought quickly of the most outlandish thing two people could do when they were meant to be rutting. "They were reading to each other." Charlie chuckled. "What, the newspaper?" Jem began, "That's not what I saw." "From a book," Maggie interrupted, her voice rising over the noise of the pub. "Poetry, I think it was." Specific details always made stories more believable. "Poetry, eh?" Dick Butterfield repeated, sucking at his beer. "I expect that'll be Paradise Lost, if they were playing at Adam and Eve in their garden." Dick Butterfield had once had a copy of the poem, in among a barrel full of books he got hold of, and was trying to sell, and had read bits of it. No one expected Dick Butterfield to be able to read so well, but his father had taught him, reasoning that it was best to be as knowledgeable as those you were trying to swindle. "Yes, that was it. Pear Tree's Loss," Maggie agreed. "I know I heard them words." "Paradise Lost, Mags. Get your words right. Now, hang on a minute." He closed his eyes, thought for a moment, then recited. "The world was all before them, where to choose their place of rest, and Providence their guide. They hand in hand with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way." His neighbors stared at him. These were not the sort of words they normally heard in the pub. "What are you saying, Pa?" Maggie asked. "The only thing I remember from Paradise Lost, the very last lines, when Adam and Eve are leaving Eden. Made me sorry for him." "I didn't hear anything like that from the Blake's garden," Jem said, then felt Maggie's sharp kick under the table. "It was after you stopped looking," she insisted. Jem opened his mouth to argue further, then stopped. Clearly, the Butterfields liked their stories embroidered. Indeed, it was the embroidery they wanted and would soon pass on to everyone else, made even more elaborate, until the whole pub was discussing the Blakes playing Adam and Eve in their garden, even when that was not what Jem had seen at all. But who was he to spoil their fun? Thank you. So that's what I do, basically. I take possible fact, make it into fiction, make it back into fact, mess around with it, add people that don't exist to it, and mix them all together. And I'm going to read another scene now, which is another story that was told about Blake. And this time it involves Philip Astley, who was in this earlier bit that I read. He has the house with the three towers behind William Blake's house in a field. And he was a very famous circus impresario. He had a circus at the end of Westminster Bridge, which is the bridge that just goes over from Big Ben. It doesn't exist there anymore, but he was very well known at the time. And when I found out in my research that Philip Astley lived next to William Blake, I thought, I can't resist that. That's the perfect gift for a novelist, because I couldn't have made it up. You know how you often have friends who, something happens to them, and say, you should write a book because you couldn't make this up. Well, it was perfect to me that there should be a circus owner next to Blake. And as far as we know, we only know one story about them meeting, running into each other. William Blake got very angry at something that Philip Astley did. And I took that story and decided to make it into a little debate between them to talk about how they view the world differently. So that's what I'm going to read. Now, it takes place in this field behind Blake's house, and Philip Astley apparently used to have his circus performers rehearse there sometimes. So Jem and Maggie, the two children, are out in the field watching this rehearsal, and they're just chatting away. As Jem and Maggie were talking, a disturbance broke in on their conversation. Wandering among the various performers in the Hercules Hall yard was a boy dragging a heavy log attached to his leg, of the sort used to keep horses from straying. A cry arose near him, and when Jem and Maggie looked over, they saw Mr. Blake standing over him. "Who has put this hobble on you, boy?" he was shouting at the terrified lad, for in his anger, even though it wasn't meant for the boy, Mr. Blake could be frightening, with his heavy brow contorted, his prominent eyes glaring like a hawk's, his stocky body thrust forward. The boy could not answer, and it was left to one of the jugglers to step forward and say, "Mr. Astley done it, sir, but loose him at once," Mr. Blake cried. "No Englishman should be subjected to such a misery. I would not treat a slave like this, no, nor even a murderer, much less an innocent child." The juggler, similarly intimidated by Mr. Blake's manner, melted into the crowd that had gathered, Maggie and Jem among them. And as no one else stepped forward to help, Mr. Blake himself knelt by the boy and began to fumble with the knots in the rope that attached the log to his leg. "There you are, my boy," he said, throwing off the rope at last. "The man who has done this to you is not fit to be your master, and a coward if he does not answer to it."
"Is someone calling me a coward?" boomed Philip Astley's unmistakable circus voice. "Stand and call me that to my face, sir."
With those words, he pushed through the crowd and stepped up to Mr. Blake, who rose to his feet and stood so close to the other man that their bellies almost touched.
"You are indeed a coward, sir, and a bully," he cried, his eyes blazing, "to do such a thing to a child." "No, Kate," he growled at Mrs. Blake, who had joined the circle of spectators and was now pulling at her husband's arm. "No, I will not stand down to intimidation. Answer me, sir, why have you shackled this innocent?"
Philip Astley glanced down at the boy, who was in tears by now with the unwanted attention, and in fact was holding on to the rope and the log as if he did not want to let it go. A small smile played across Philip Astley's lips, and he took a step back, the flames of his anger quenched.
"Ah, sir, it is the hobble you're objecting to, is it?" "Of course I'm objecting to it. Any civilized man would. No one deserves such treatment. You must desist and make amends, sir. You apologize to the lad, and to us too, for making us witness such degradation."
Rather than reply in kind, Philip Astley chuckled, a response which made Mr. Blake bunch his fists at his side and lunge forward.
"Do you think this is a jest, sir? I assure you it is not."
Philip Astley held up his hands in a placatory gesture. "Tell me, Mr. Blake, is it? My neighbor, I believe, though we've not met. Well, Mr. Blake, I should like to inquire, have you asked the boy why he's wearing the log?"
"I don't need to ask," Mr. Blake replied. "It's clear as day that the child is being punished in this barbarous manner."
"Still, perhaps we should hear from the lad."
"Davy!"
Philip Astley turned his foghorn towards the boy, who did not cower from it, as he had from Mr. Blake's twisted brow and fiery eyes. He was used to Astley's boom.
"Why were you wearing the log, lad?"
"'Cause you put it on me, sir," the boy replied.
"You see?"
Mr. Blake turned to the crowd for support. Philip Astley held up a hand again.
"And why did I put it on you, Davy?"
"So's I could get used to it, sir, for the show."
"Which show is that?"
"The panto, sir.
Harlequin's Vagaries."
"And what part are you playing in this pantomime?"
"Prisoner, sir."
"And what are you doing now, Davy?"
"Rehearsing, sir."
"Rehearsing," Philip Astley repeated, turning with a flourish back to Mr. Blake, who was still glaring at him. "You see, Davy was rehearsing a part, sir. He was pretending. You, sir, of all people, will understand that. You are an engraver, are you not, sir? An artist. I have seen your work, and very fine it is, very fine. You capture an essence, sir. Yes, you do." Mr. Blake looked as if he did not want to be affected by this flattery, but was nonetheless. "You create things, do you not, sir?" Philip Astley continued. "You draw real things, but your drawings, your engravings, are not the thing itself, are they? They are illusions, sir. I think despite our differences..." He glanced sideways at Mr. Blake's plain black coat, as against his own red one with its gleaming brass buttons. "We are in the same business, sir. We are both dealers in illusions. You make 'em with your pen and ink engraver, while I make a world out of people and props every night at the amphitheater. I take the audience out of their world of cares and woes, and I give 'em fantasy, so they think they're somewhere else. Now, in order to make it look real, sometimes we have to do real. If Davy here is to play a prisoner, we get him to drag a prisoner's hobble. No one would believe in him as a prisoner if he were just dancing about now, would they? Just as you make your drawings from real people..." "That is not where my drawings come from," Mr. Blake interrupted. He had been listening with great interest, and now spoke more normally, the sting of anger drawn from him. "But I understand you, sir, I do. However, I see it differently. You are making a distinction between reality and illusion. You see them as opposites, do you not?" "Of course," Philip Astley replied. "To me, they are not opposites at all. They are all one thing. Young Davy playing a prisoner is a prisoner. Another example, my brother Robert, standing over there..." He pointed to an empty patch of sunlight, which everyone turned to stare at. "My brother is the same to me as someone whom I may touch." He reached out and flicked the sleeve of Philip Astley's red coat. Philip Astley was not inclined to take on such heady topics. He gave the dusty, empty spot a perfunctory glance, though clearly Robert Blake was not there, then turned back to Mr. Blake with a quizzical look, as if trying to think how to respond to this unusual observation. In the end, he decided not to probe, and perhaps be drawn further into uncharted territory, which would take more time and patience than he had. "So you see, sir," he said, as if there had been no digression, "Davy is not being punished with his log. I can see your concern, sir, and how it must have looked to you. It is very humane of you. But I can assure you, sir, Davy is well looked after, aren't you, lad? Off you go now." He handed the boy a penny. Mr. Blake was not finished, however. "You create worlds each night at your circus," he announced. "But when the audience is gone, and the torches have been blown out, and the doors locked, what is left but the memory of them?" "Very fine memories they are, sir. And nothing wrong with that. They see a man through many a cold, lonely night." "Undoubtedly. But that is where we differ, sir. My songs and pictures do not become memories. They are always there to be looked at. And they are not illusions, but physical manifestations of worlds that do exist." Philip Astley looked about him theatrically, as if trying to catch sight of the back of his coat. "Where do they exist, sir? I have not seen these worlds." Mr. Blake tapped his brow. Philip Astley snorted. "Then you have a head teeming with life, sir. Teeming? You must find it hard to sleep for the clamor." Mr. Blake smiled. "It is true that I've never needed much sleep." Philip Astley wrinkled his brow and stood still in thought, a pose highly unusual for him. "What you are saying, sir, if I understand you," he said at last, "is that you are taking ideas in your head and making them into something you can see and hold in your hand, while I am taking real things, horses and acrobats and dancers, and turning them into memories." "That is one way of considering it." "Well, then, sir, I would say that the world needs us both." Philip Astley stepped forward and extended his hand, We will shake hands on it, Mr. Blake, won't we?
Mr. Blake reached over and took the circus man's proffered hand. We will indeed. Thank you. Now, I would be very happy to answer questions on whatever you want to ask me. I see a hand. Yes.
One of your books that I liked a great deal was...
Hard to remember all those titles,
yeah,
isn't it?
The
question for those in the back who haven't heard is, there is a set of unicorn tapestries called the Lady and the Unicorn tapestries, medieval tapestries, in the Cluny Museum in Paris. And I wrote my last novel was about them, and she would like to know how I got the idea for them. I had a great, in the mid-70s when I was a teenager, I had this unicorn craze. Now, I don't know if there are any other women out there of my age, in 40s, did you have a unicorn craze too? Yes, raise your hands if you had a unicorn craze, yes. It was a marketing ploy, but I didn't realize it at the time. And it's only actually when I was going on book tour that I kept seeing so many people nodding about it, and I thought, yeah, and they were all of a certain age. So I think we all had the posters, the stickers to put in the window, and jewelry. And I had this book that had these six tapestries, in the Lady and the Unicorn tapestries, and I loved them. I thought they are incredibly beautiful. And they have a lady and a unicorn and a lion, and it's meant to be the lady's seduction of a unicorn, because the idea is that a unicorn can be hunted, can't be captured except by a virgin. If a virgin goes out in the woods and sits, he will come and lay his head in her lap. And Freud would have had a field day with that, but never mind. Anyway, I rediscovered the tapestries many years later. You know, I saw them, read an article about them, and they said they didn't know why they had been made or who they were made for. They thought maybe it was this one family. And I always go for the mystery. You know, if there's a gap to be filled, I want to fill it. And that made me think, oh, I really want to write about these. So that was the first inspiration. Yeah. Any other? Yes. Yeah, all that. The question is, how do I do my research? Where do I start? Usually what happens is I've had like an inspiration like, like medieval tapestries, or a painting by Vermeer, or a man called William Blake. And I, what I first do is I research that specific topic. And I do that normally by, there are often, I buy books sometimes, and I go to, I happen to live very near the British Library as well, which has like every book in the world. So I go there, and I often will contact somebody who's like an expert in the field, and or you just have to get that first article or book that then gives you a good bibliography. So you find a good bibliography, and sometimes you can find that online. And I do go online. I use both libraries, and I do use the internet. Though I have to say, there's so much information on the internet that actually hasn't been verified that it's. I always use it with a grain of salt and try to check it elsewhere too and stuff. So it's a combination of all of those things. And then when I get my ideas, I start to think, okay, I know a bit about Blake. Now I know I want to write about him writing his very famous poems called Songs of Experience. That's set in London in this area called Lambeth in 1792. So I thought, okay, now I have to research. I've researched Blake. Now I have to research the area he lives in, Lambeth. And then I think, okay, now I need to find out more about London of that time. Now I need to find out more about the French Revolution, which was taking place then. So it's like these concentric circles of information that get more and more general. And then I start writing, and then things get thrown up that I have to find out. So a lot of little details, like I'll be having a family sit down to eat. And if I haven't already worked out from all my research what they'd be eating, then I have to start, oh, I don't know, what would they? Or, you know, this is set during Easter. Would they be wearing, did women wear Easter bonnets then? I got to go find out. So it's all those real specific detailed questions that I come back to in the end of the research. Does that sort of explain? Okay. Yeah. Okay. The question is about the novel Falling Angels, which is told from 12 different characters' points of view. And she would like to know if I wrote it consecutively or did I write like all of one character and then chop them up and mix and match. I wrote it consecutively, but I wrote the first draft all in third person, except for a couple of sections which I kept being tempted to write in first person, two of the kids, Simon the Gravedigger and Lavinia. For some reason I kept wanting to write first person with them, and I should have learned, you learn with each book. As I was writing the first draft, I kept being really bored by it. Except when I'd get to these sections, which I was going to write in the first person, in the voice of these kids, and then I'd think, oh, thank God, it's a Simon day, I can write, and then it'd come very easily. And the thing is, if I'm bored when I'm writing, then you are going to be triply bored. So when I finished it and I read the draft, and I just thought, oh, this doesn't work at all. I have got to do something else. And I thought, well, maybe I should tell it in first person instead of third person. So whose point of view shall I tell it from? And I thought, but there's so many people who are important. And I had just read the Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver, which is told from five different points of view, and it very successfully, I thought. So I thought, ooh, that's this works for others. Maybe I should try it. So but I did. I already knew what the story was because I had it in third person. So I tried to work out who would each story. So I rewrote, but consecutively. Yes, way at the back. The question is, what did I think of the final product of Girl with a Pearl Earring, the movie? Can I ask you first what you thought of it? You best stand up, though, so that everybody can hear you. The point about the baby, because that's what happens when you publish a book, too. You know, when I publish this, it goes out to you. This is my baby, and I hand it to you, and you it's no longer mine. And you make of it what you will, and some of you like it, and some of you don't, and some of you... You know, some people come to me, ask me questions all the time about the book, like things that I never occurred to me that I might have been doing. You know, it's like, was the theme this? And I think, I don't know. And but I have to let it go. I just, and so in a way, because I had already had that experience of letting go Girl with a Pearl Earring, the book, it wasn't as painful letting go the film as I expected it might be. I guess I had some experience of that. So I was pretty happy with it, too. I think what my biggest criticism of it was that I felt that the secondary characters became rather cardboard, so that the Vermeer's wife was just shrewish, his mother-in-law was just sort of tough old boot, and the patron was just a lech. And the sad thing is that in the screenplay, all of those characters have a lot more airplay, and there was some great acting went on with these secondary characters. I know because I visited the set a couple times, had a great time watching, and I remember seeing certain scenes that were, there's this whole long dialogue that Van Ryven, the patron, and Vermeer's wife have sitting in front of the fire. Great acting, lots of stuff come out, and they used literally a quarter of it in the final product. And what the director said to me is, look, the important thing, we can't make this film too long, and the important thing is devote all of our energies to the central relationship and spend time, give them the time. So it meant that he had to cut back on the, and I think, I sort of wish there could be a director's cut that would be like even just 10 minutes longer, just to give a little bit more. I know a lot of people have a lot of problems with the beginning, because in the beginning of the book, Vermeer and his wife visit the house, Greet's house, when she's chopping vegetables and she's laying them out in this pattern, and he sees, she has an eye, I'm going to hire her. She has an eye for composition and color. And what they did was they filmed that scene, and then when they edited it, they said it didn't work, and they cut it so that it was just showed her doing the vegetables, but he wasn't visiting her. And the reason they did that is because in the book, one of the great powers of the book is that Vermeer remains a mystery. He's this central mystery, but a mystery nonetheless. And the thing is, when you have a very famous actor like Colin Firth play Vermeer, there's no mystery there. The moment you see him, it's like, it's Colin Firth playing Vermeer. You kind of have to... So when they filmed the first scene, and they had the scene in the beginning, Colin Firth appears, like, you know, immediately, and you just think, there's Colin Firth playing Vermeer, and the mystery is just not there at all. And they realize that that scene, this is all about the way films tell stories in a different way from books. And so they had to cut it out, and in fact, there isn't a close-up on Vermeer for a good 15 minutes. They had to kind of artificially build in the mystery from all of the filming that they had done. That was the thing, is like they didn't realize that it was a problem until they cut it long after the set had been broken down and everybody had gone their separate ways. So you have to use what you've got. So That was one instance. Anyway, I've gone on an awfully long time, but that was, I felt pretty good about it. My feeling was that the film and the book, the book didn't suffer from the film, put it that way, and that they sort of sit side by side reasonably well, like sisters, but not the same thing. Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. The question is, she's a fifth grade teacher. Yes. I can name all of my teachers. I had Miss Reed for fifth grade. And you teach writing to your kids, and they use different techniques for writing, and you want to know what techniques I use. I think the problem with that question is not a problem. It's what's hard is that I just sort of do it, and I don't really analyze what I do the way a teacher has to analyze so that you can teach. And I think one of the things I do is I always... I work in this little room at the back of the house, and I have a wall next to my desk, and I paste stuff up there for each book. And then at the end of the book, when it's all finally done, I take it all down, and this time I painted the walls a different color. They had been yellow for Blake, and now they're blue for what I'm writing now. I put up, like with Blake, I had this big map from a photocopy of this 18th century map that was really useful, and it was up there, and there were Blake postcards all around, and there were all these illustrations from the circus, from Astley's Circus, and a picture of Philip Astley, and I, every time I'd sort of get stuck, I'd just look up and just look at something, and sometimes you don't, you know, things become a bit like wallpaper and you don't notice them, and so when you stand up and really look at them, it's like, oh, so that was kind of what got me. But I know that's not like saying I use metaphor a lot. I'm really sorry, I do use metaphor a lot, but I'd say that's one of the tricks I use to try to jumpstart myself if I'm having problems. I'm an extremely visual writer, and I tend to, I mean, you could say to them, what I tend to do is I visualize a scene in my head like it's a little film turning. So I have the scene and I look and I watch what the characters are all doing, and then I write down what I see. So that's a technique. I don't know what you call it, but you could try that with them. Okay. Yeah.
That worked perfectly into the question I was going to ask.
Okay.
Can
excellent.
Give us a hint of what you're working on now.
Oh, what I'm working on now. I have an 8-year-old son, which may explain some of this. I am writing a novel about a fossil collector named Mary Anning. She lived in Lyme Regis, which is a little town on the coast, southern coast of England. She lived in the 19th century. She was working class, and she used to collect fossils on the beach and sell them to people to make a living for her family. And she discovered some of the first pre-dinosaur fossils in England. She discovered ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs long before they knew what they were, and she developed her own theories on what they were, and the novel is going to be about her and her interaction with these male geologists who would buy the fossils from her and then go and come up with all these theories. So that's what I'm working on. And I had the idea from taking my son around a dinosaur museum down in Dorset, and there was a little section on Mary Anning. There's a little sketch of her wearing a top hat, which was going to protect her from the rubble, because fossil collectors, hunters, they tend to go out during storms and when there are landslides, and she would go out then, and it was to protect her from that. And she had her little dog and her pickaxe and her basket, and also the thing I loved about her, too, was, I mean, this is like, you couldn't make this up, she was struck by lightning as a baby. And she survived, but the woman who was carrying her, the two women next to her, all died. And they said that Mary had been quite a lethargic baby and suddenly became very energetic. And I thought, yes, that's my woman. I've got to write about her. Great. I think we have time for one or two more questions, if anybody has any. Yeah. It's one of those things I didn't want to, the book is, this is about falling angels, and it's told from children's point of view, some of the children, and it starts when they're 5, and they are awfully articulate and knowledgeable for that age. It's true, but I kind of fudged it a bit because I didn't want to write, if you write from a truly 5-year-old point of view, you're not going to get very far. And no, it's a fault, I admit it. I can say that now, you know, I'm a couple of books down. I make mistakes all the time, and I think I would have changed, I would change that now if I could. Yeah. Last question. There's one way in the back. Yes, you. No, yeah. Oh, you're turning around. Yes, no, not. Yes.
Like you have
It isn't, and this is one of those instances where I just do it, and then it's afterwards people point it out to me, and I think, oh, yeah, I do use a lot of color. I have no idea why. I'm not a painter. I'm a real verbal person. I'm very much influenced by and intrigued and inspired by visual things, but I don't actually make things myself using color. So I don't know. It's just one of those things. Sorry. Now, there was one last question. Okay. How did I come to live in England? It was just a whim. Started out being a whim. I went to Oberlin College in Ohio, and my junior year, first semester, I went and on the London semester for English majors. And there were 18 of us English majors and a professor, and we had a great time, and I fell in love with London. I just thought it was a great city. And completely different from Washington, D.C., which is where I'm from. So when I graduated, I thought I wanted to be in books, I wanted to be in publishing, but I wasn't quite ready to move to New York and do the publishing thing there. So these two friends and I just said, let's go to London for 6 months, because you could get a work permit for 6 months. So we did. And then after 6 months, they went back, but I met a guy, and you know how it goes. And now I have an English husband, and you know, it's just sort of, I didn't plan to stay, but it just kind of happened. So now I've been there 22 years, and I moved there when I was 22, so I'm just right in the balance now. So right here, yeah, in the middle of the Atlantic. Anyway, on that note, thank you so much for all of you coming out. I feel so honored. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Rachel Johnson, Jonathan Lethem, Sarah Davidson, Craig Childs, Michael Chabon, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on March 26th, 2007.